Hey East Meets West listeners. After my recent travels, in this episode, we're taking a look at tech in Indonesia. It's been 5 years since I last visited Jakarta, so we unpack what's changed on the ground. Everything from payments and mobility to apps and cultural trends. Projected to be one of the top five economies by 2050, Indonesia tech is definitely a space to keep an eye on. Keep listening and enjoy. Welcome to the East Meets West podcast, a podcast about understanding Asia tech and how Asia tech affects the world. My name is Dan. Joining me as always from Astral Ventures, Albert. How are you doing?
Dan, I'm going good. It's only the middle of the week. We're both feeling a bit tired from the week, but I think this will be a really fun pod because you are back in the country after spending some time away. Do you want to quickly talk about that?
Yeah. So for the last week plus, I've been in Indonesia. First stop, Jakarta. Second stop, Bali. As all good Australians have to check into the second homeland of Bali. Really, really good trip. I mean, it's been, I think by my count, 4 years or so since I was last in Indonesia. COVID obviously meant that I couldn't go back. Reasons for the trip is, you know, I'm going to be relocating there soon. So work sort of sent me over to meet the team and check out the office. So it was a good time to be on the ground and definitely a good spark for this week's episode, Albert. You sort of mentioned to me offline, you know, we can talk about what apps you've downloaded, what you saw on the ground. And I thought, oh, that's actually, yeah, I have downloaded a couple. There's a couple of new things on my phone, which I think it's a fertile ground to unpack for this week's episode.
Nice. This is probably going to be a largely unstructured conversation, but I think given we are now East meets West, I thought why not the perfect opportunity to kind of put you on the hot seat. We can talk about a few things and literally talk about East meets West. I guess first up, Dan, why don't you tell us, like, talk through, like, on the ground, what's it like in Indonesia? We talk about mobile first being a big thing in Asia and Southeast Asia in particular. Do you see that? Does it feel different? Like, well, what's the sense there that you get from being in Indonesia?
Yeah, it's hugely, hugely different. Like, and if I can set the scene, particularly in speaking about Jakarta, you know, you're walking into this ginormous city, which is just constantly bustling. You've got warungs, these street stalls lining the sides. You constantly have traffic going back and forth, and not just cars, but just like, you know, if every car, there's probably two or three motorbikes, sort of electric scooters, those sorts of things zooming past. You've got street stores selling cigarettes, satay, coffee. In the office, you know, you've got this funny mix of formalism where you obviously have suit and ties, shirts and trousers. Then you've got these batik sort of shirts instead of corporate hoodies, people wearing sandals instead of shoes. So a really, really diverse mix. And then from my experience, just food being absurdly cheap, you know, I'd be going to restaurants, which in Australia you'd probably be paying $25, $30 per head. And there it's like a third of the cost. So it's just a big difference. Definitely, even I, you know, with my experience in Indonesia, experienced a little bit of culture shock where you're just like, wow, this is very, very different, feeling like you're walking on the street in a completely different world. And that's what makes it so exciting. You know, that's the reason why I'm planning to move there. And it's really exciting to see like what that produces in terms of like business, tech scene, thoughts, perspectives on, you know, making money. And that's such a huge promoting factor about Indonesia, I think, as a growing economy.
Nice. That's awesome. I think maybe good to understand this cultural shock element a bit more. And then maybe we can talk more things specific around, are we talking the pod, e-commerce, content, etc. Like, what were the things that shocked you? What are the things that you expected? What was different since you were last there?
Yeah, so I mean, let's just talk about some of the things that were different since I was last there. As I'm coming down from the airport, so it's about an hour taxi from the airport into the city, which, you know, is a bit of a problem in of itself in terms of infrastructure, connectivity. But as I'm streaming past, you immediately notice that advertising is completely different than 5 years ago. You have all of these billboards, which are now TV screens as opposed to, you know, the classic banners that you might have. So it feels like a very modern city. And then it's just not like the billboards themselves, but like the content that's on those billboards. so much K-pop promotion, you know, in terms of you had Lisa from Blackpink promoting like an investing platform or app. And I think that speaks to a couple of things. One is that clearly there's this really strong Eastern influence. Like, you know, you're not having American celebrities like Kim Kardashian promoting there. It is very much, you know, focused towards some of Eastern superstars, celebrities in terms of Korean K-pop stars, but then also advertising things like investing apps. You know, that's something that you would not have seen 5 years ago with a population that is very largely unbanked and definitely not investing in things. So I think just that image of having those screens, someone promoting from Korea and the app that they're promoting, it's actually a really good mix to tell you about some of the changes that's happened in Indonesia recently.
Yeah, this is a good, you know, potential segue. I was in the Philippines very recently, maybe about 2 months ago. You obviously in Indonesia last week. I think something that was a really big surprise to me was just how completely integrated some of these like consumer apps were when it comes to things like payments, when it comes to things like investing. So in the Philippines, one of the biggest companies is a business called Globe, and they run this app called GCash where you can scan a QR code to transfer money. So instead of having like a BSB number, an account number, you just show someone your GCash QR code, then you can choose how much money you can transfer. If you want to, you know, deposit money into your GCash account, you can do that at like a GCash ATM or at a store. You hand over cash and they give you the QR code scan. And so something that you could then also do is obviously invest. But to me, it was so bizarre that you've got this like QR code investing app within a broader payments app. Like, what kind of cool payments or like applications have you got on your phone? Do you have anything like that? Did you start investing in Indonesian companies while you're there?
Definitely it wasn't that bold, but payments is a big sector and theme for Indonesia. So, you know, over 47 million adults there don't really have access to mainstream financial services. 92 million people in Indonesia have never used a bank. So, you know, being unbanked is a huge issue there. And it's interesting when you look at issues, how have they tried to solve it? You know, what are the solutions that have popped up? And it hasn't been sort of micro payments, buy now, pay later. That isn't really it. It's, you know, these QR codes, it's really actually leveraging banks as gateways. So I think in Australia and other places, you've kind of seen this rise of neobanks almost trying to disrupt the banking sector and go around them. Whereas in Indonesia, I think so much more of it is still leveraging the trust that big institutions like banks have, but then just solving that friction point of like, oh, it's a hassle to go to an ATM and take out cash. And now you have these QR codes to scan instead and leverage your phones. The interesting thing for me, Albert, is, you know, the equivalent in Australia is rather than scanning a QR code to pay for something is we would tap and pay, like with our card, or would have our card on our phone and tap and pay. That's not really a thing in Indonesia. Like, it's still very much the QR code or cash, or you insert your card. And to me, that's just an interesting feature because I don't see why there's a technological hurdle towards the tap and pay. I'm wondering if that's a cultural thing or something else that's holding up that transition.
It is a very Australian thing. I think even when I was in the States a number of years ago, like tap and go or tap and pay was not that mature. I think it almost like skipped a step even in the US because they've got such shoddy, you know, payments infrastructure that they went straight to Apple Pay and kind of digital wallets. I think Australia actually has quite good payment infrastructure relative to a lot of other countries, which is probably why we're ahead when it comes to payments. I think something that was probably good to also unpick was like, did you download any kind of content and streaming businesses? I know when I was in the Philippines, I couldn't use Netflix, Amazon Prime or those because it was geo-blocked based on my account. Like, did you end up having much free time to do a bit of content watching?
No, I didn't explore the content scene. That was interesting to see, you know, those advertisements for Bilibili around. So like there is a presence of some of these Chinese content businesses. In addition to that, as you said, like I noticed a lot of my usual watches, whether it be YouTube or whatever else, started having geo-blocking on it. So there's certain channels that I couldn't access. And that, I think, is an interesting rabbit hole, which we're not going to go down this episode, but maybe in another one, was just when we think about content, and we've often talked about how, you know, content is king, going back to that Bill Gates essay, but we rarely talk about how content can get restricted and gated and who are the gatekeepers.
Yep.
And in a country like Indonesia, frankly, like, you know, if you go to America, Canada obviously has Pornhub as, you know, being these huge industries and businesses. Indonesia has a lot of censorship. And so, you know, I'm not saying I was looking up those kinds of websites, Albert, but
sure.
even manga websites, anime websites, these sorts of things, like Reddit to a certain extent, they're all actually gatekept and restricted. And so, you know, in terms of a content friendly market, Indonesia isn't one that comes front of center.
Yeah, that's such a good point. I'm not saying that you were looking, but I think, you know, there's obviously layers to it when it comes to like licensing agreements for content streaming rights, and, you know, different distributors and different platforms have rights to, you know, different pieces of content globally, and whether they can do it in specific regions. And then there's like the element of censorship from, you know, like, for lack of a better word, Western influence and these markets. Obviously, China is a great example of that, but it, you know, the Philippines is the same. I'm sure Indonesia is also the same.
It's not just censorship, and this one I'm going to have to put a strong caveat on it, because I have not verified the correctness of this. This was told to me by my boss as we were wandering around Bali, but as he tells it, the trademark and logo for Ralph Lauren is actually not owned by Ralph Lauren Global or US, wherever they're based. It's actually some entrepreneurial Indonesian person who filed the local trademark. And so by this reasoning, my boss says, if you ever purchase Ralph Lauren in Indonesia, it is not authentic. It is all done by this sort of local person who's stolen the branding, which if this is true, it goes to a broader point about, you know, I guess the lack of robustness of the legal system in Indonesia for international companies to protect their brands, protect content in terms of what we're talking about earlier, Albert, and for these sort of local players to just sort of get an inside track on the content, on the IP, and profit from it themselves. And that's part of doing business in Asia. You don't have those protections that you would have in other countries out west.
Yeah, and to be honest, I don't think that many of these, I don't want to put words here, so I'm just speculating that I'm sure a lot of these companies aren't necessarily too concerned, given that some of these people wouldn't have bought their product to begin with because, you know, the difference in pricing and wage earnings and things like that. So the fact that they can get a bit of brand eminence, even from like, you know, replicas or things like that, means that as these developing nations got up the curve to become developed nations, they'll ideally follow the same playbook because they've got and built brand eminence because of these reps.
So I just to follow up this little anecdote, I've just Googled and up pops, you know, ChatGPT is obviously working in Google or something, but now they've got, is Ralph Lauren in Indonesia real? Ralph Lauren International has reiterated the store location in Indonesia is not correct. They currently have no stores in Indonesia. So take from that what you will.
That's actually so funny. That's actually so funny. Cool. I think I want to quickly talk about, you know, how you see a shift in your like day-to-day apps. So like a big one we talk about, you know, a lot, obviously, was like Uber, you know, there's Grab, you know, Amazon, we've spoken about a few times, but never really covered in depth in the pod. They've obviously got like Blablapark, which we have covered, and Tokopedia, Shopee, all these different things. Like, did you try some of those? How do they work? What's logistics like? What's the reputation like?
Yeah, so I'm taking a step back. I think if I'm trying to summarize what particularly the tech landscape in Indonesia is, it is hugely consumer focused. So if you just look at some of the top apps which I could have downloaded and you know, the top tech companies in Indonesia, you've got GoTo, which is a combination of like a ride hailing app as well as an online sort of store, Traveloka, a leading sort of travel accommodation company, Bukalapak e-commerce, Grab, as you mentioned, ride hailing, Allo Doctor, online medical services, Ruang Guru, online education services. they're all hyper-focused as you, as a consumer, and are either sort of subscription or the sort of platform where they take a cut of what you're putting through it. So they really rely on scale, which Indonesia obviously has in terms of scale of users. And then when you actually dive in, the apps are really quite good. I was using Grab mostly, and I think that reinforces the Grab tagline. You know, it's a super app. I found that I could basically do everything I needed to do through Grab itself. So that could be getting either a taxi or car, getting a bike, getting food delivered, like doing shopping, all of it I could do through Grab. And the interesting thing for me was I could do that having no local bank account, no local ID or anything like that. I literally just, you know, touched down at the airport, downloaded the app, and I was going pretty, pretty quickly. They had translation services. So, you know, obviously I can speak the language, but if I was getting messages in Indonesian, there's an auto translate. If I wanted to go to English, I could type in English and the rider could auto translate to Indonesian. So if you're thinking about all of those sticky situations where, you know, a tourist is trying to find out where their driver is and says, you know, I'm down the street, where are you? All of that is now getting picked up through these app interfaces. All these little problems are getting solved, which makes it, you know, just a really compelling app experience.
Yeah, that's so interesting that you can go through that onboarding process with almost no friction. I know, like when you do Uber, you obviously got the card details. If you yep. do like the, yep. The facial, you know, verification, there's, I wouldn't say much onboarding friction because it's obviously very good, but there is some onboarding friction.
Yeah, I mean, if we take sort of the second half of your question there, Albert, which was, you know, what's sort of the local perceptions of some of these apps on the ground? I was surprised, you know, as an outsider, I thought, you know, if you compare a Gojek Go-To app, which is Indonesian founders, to a Grab, which started out in Singapore, I thought there'd be a much greater sort of nationalism around some of these apps. And that's not really the case. You know, everyone I talked to really just sort of highlighted the user experience. And I found that for different uses, they had different preferences for apps. When it came to ride hailing, I actually found a greater preference to use Grab compared to Gojek. But then when it came to payments, you know, GoPay, Gojek became much more of a featured app. So that goes to me to speak to all of these apps, all these consumer products. You really have to treat your customer well, and then the customer will pay that back with loyalty. There's no sort of friendly branding or marketing, which I think is going to engender that customer loyalty. It really is about performance, which, you know, it's something the tech sector is used to, but it goes to show how I think sensitive the Indonesian market is to potentially changing apps depending on the performance they're given.
Yeah, yeah. I think I got kind of two questions and we probably can wrap this up. I think the first is, like, I want to talk about social because obviously consumer social, huge. I'm not sure if you've kind of been keeping up with what's going on, but like a Gas app just sold to Discord. I don't know if you know anything about Gas app, but it's like an app where, yeah, teens can kind of complement each other. It was a US base. But apps like that have existed in Asia for so long. Like Asia's almost always like their experimental ground for consumer social. Like, did you get a good sense of what consumer social looks like? Is it Facebook? Is it Snapchat? Is it something else? Like, what's the lay of the land on consumer social?
Yeah, it's interesting because I'll take the consumer out of it. I'd say it's mostly social. You know, when we talk about some of the big China social apps, it definitely is consumer social. You know, you've got Tmall, etc., where part of the social experience is baked in to the consumerism around the app as well. Instagram is huge in Indonesia, and to a certain extent you've got that consumerism built in there. You know, you've got ads which you can click, but even then, when you talk about that consumerism experience, to purchase something through Instagram, you have to go off the platform. The other big app is WhatsApp, which again, you know, if you're purchasing something through WhatsApp, it's because a friend is sending you a link, you click the link, you're off the platform. So I haven't seen that combination of social and consumerism in Indonesia, but social's big and it penetrates all the way through business. Like WhatsApp groups is a core way of communicating with your work colleagues, not emails or anything else. And that to me is an interesting feature of Indonesian communities to see like how that will eventually be monetized or leveraged in sort of Western markets, you see productivity apps like Teams, etc., filling that gap. WhatsApp is kind of playing that role here. So it's interesting to see where that might turn to next. Because, I mean, from my use of it, WhatsApp just isn't built for a sort of teaming environment. So how do they level up that experience?
Yeah. So when I say consumer social, I mean things like, you know, Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat. I think the other flip side of that is something that Asia does really well, which is like social commerce, which is like group buys, you know, like integrated buying with you know, TikTok and things like that. But I think you're right. Like, obviously, like group buying. I think I saw group buying business do really well recently in the US. And it was on like A16Z's kind of big thing for 2023, which is like social commerce in the US. They were talking about how they're looking for whichever startup will just copy whatever's successful in Southeast Asia and integrate into the US, which I thought was pretty funny. I think before we kind of close off, you know, obviously it's East meets West. Like, what are the things that you think that we can take away from Indonesia tech or Indonesia more broadly, kind of in Australia and probably more Western tech companies?
It's tough. I think they're actually on different tracks. You know, I think when you look at the parallels, you know, you mentioned, I think when we're talking about that e-commerce platform in America, which is sort of taking cues from the East and copying Pinduoduo, I don't see that kind of parallel that you can draw between Indonesia and some other countries, mainly because if we go back to like the core of what makes a good tech company succeed, I think it's they identify a problem and then they craft a solution to meet that problem. And the problems a lot of Indonesian companies are focused on are hyper-specific to Indonesia. Like, and I think one of the real big problems or issues which these tech companies are currently grappling with is that urban versus regional divide. So much growth and tech adoption is happening in city centers like Jakarta, but that hasn't found its way into the regional areas. So if I think about, like, you know, what are the lessons east to west to learn? I actually don't think there's that many. I think it's east to east. You know, I think a lot of Indonesian companies are going to be looking at the China experience, how tech companies broadened out from the tier one cities into the tier two, tier three, etc., because those are the problems that are relevant to Indonesia. And I can't see too many problems Indonesia have that are necessarily relevant to Western countries.
Yeah, no, interesting. Good shout out about Pinduoduo's American subsidiary, Temu. You know, it's actually been one of the hottest apps over the past couple of months in the US. It's group buying. It's actually been like number one app in the App Store, on the you know, Apple App Store for like 30 days this year, which is, it's pretty unreal to be number one for 30 days, given that we're only like, you know, 50, you know, three-ish days into the year. So maybe one that we can cover in more detail later, but you know, just to kind of round off the pod, any closing thoughts, anything about Indonesia you want to give off?
Yeah, I mean, this is just a bit of a tease, I think, but you know, it's probably to do with my age bracket and everything else. But one piece of tech or one app, or not one app, but a series of apps that everyone is sort of downloading is dating apps. It's really, really big in Indonesia. I was surprised. You know, you think, given some of the religious connotations and stuff, that you know, those sort of dating apps wouldn't be as prevalent. Everyone my age and younger and older that I was speaking to, you know, are on these apps or trying these apps, and it's sort of like now a must to meet people for romantic relationships. And with a population of, you know, almost 300 million, that's a sizable market. So that's really interesting to me.
You're going to come back with RSI from all that finger swiping you're going to do. Is there anything that those like dating apps are doing differently? Can you say? This obviously makes you complicit in downloading these apps, right?
I haven't downloaded any of them yet. But in terms of commentary, again, it goes to different use cases. So I think the branding is really important for the apps, because some of them are just known as hookup apps. Others are known more for finding relationships. Others are sort of religious specific, so some are, you know, for Islamic dating, some are for Catholic dating, etc. So I would expect that, contrary to maybe other markets like Australia, you probably have a greater diversity of dating apps because you've got the population size to support those sort of niches. In Australia, I don't think you have that, but an interesting space, because I don't think any one player has really captured the market the way that, you know, Tinder has in some markets or Bumble in others.
Interesting. Do you know if they're subsidiaries of, like, you know, Match Group and things like that?
Tinder's definitely in Indonesia. Bumble is as well. I don't think Hinge is Albert's, but an app called Coffee Meets Bagel is fairly popular. So there you go. There's a few. I'm revealing my hand, Albert.
Maybe it's a good time to shut off before you start pleading the fifth.
Okay, Albert, any last thoughts from you?
No, I think this is a good kind of little catch-up pod. I think, you know, if anyone out there listening, we'll definitely do a deep dive into Temu. I think it'll be really interesting to talk about the Pinduoduo business, but in the US, and kind of the challenges and opportunities there. But yeah, Dan, good to have you back, even temporarily.
Good to be back. So let's finish up there, Albert. Thank you for listening to the East Meets West podcast. Support the pod, rate it 5 stars on Apple iTunes, subscribe, follow, and all the rest. And we'll catch you next week. Thanks again. See ya.